do the average based on however long that cohort has been around. And if the other ones are, you know, seem like they're directionally going that way, then great. And then as you get more information, you can start to build your model and add to it. But, you know, I think part of the thing also to be careful of it, depending on how long the business has been around, is how many people are you looking at? So if you got 100 customers versus 10,000, you trust more volume, right?
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
So, Mark, I know that amongst all the Quiet Light brokers, Jason is probably the fittest, but I occasionally do get my butt kicked by someone online with Beachbody.com. Most recently, a young lady, I can't remember her name, but I keep going back to it. I love the program and I love the story behind Beachbody's success because, as you know, I'm an old radio spot ad, radio infomercial, TV infomercial guy. And that is where Beachbody started, I believe. And you had them on the podcast. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. I think pretty much everybody's heard of Beachbody at some point or another, right? I mean, it's a huge brand, huge name. I was able to talk to Bob Akazad. He was the senior vice president for media and acquisitions. Really fancy title, big companies, that comes with the big companies are fancy titles. But his role at Beachbody was to figure out their customer acquisition strategy. And this is what he does now. He's no longer with Beachbody. He did leave a little while ago. He's now with Round 2 Ventures, and they help e-commerce companies, eight-figure and nine-figure primarily, e-commerce companies, hone in on their customer acquisition strategies. What was great about this discussion is seeing this at scale, seeing what somebody who's in charge of a business that when he came into Beachbody, they were doing $100 million in revenue annually, right? That's a lot of money.
That's a lot.
When he left, and just a few years later, they were doing over $1 billion in annual revenue.
Wow. How long was he there for?
I don't know. I would have to take a look to see, but it wasn't more than a few years. So he's really responsible for the explosive growth. I mean, again, a lot of people have heard about Beachbody. I remember hearing about them way back when I was in college, which unfortunately is too long ago now. So I remember hearing about them then. Now, I mean, everybody knows Beachbody. Everybody knows the brand. And a lot was because of his customer acquisition strategy. We talked a lot about what that was. And we talked a lot about problems, mistakes he sees, especially in seven-figure e-commerce businesses and even eight-figure e-commerce businesses as they're trying to grow. I'll leave some of the mystery for the actual episode here, but a couple of things that I pulled away from this that I thought were really good. One, he said that if he comes across a company and they have more than four main acquisition channels, that he's guaranteed they're wasting money and that they are completely, that they're not doing what they should. So people get all worked up and they think, oh, I need to be on Pinterest. I need to be on Instagram. I need to be on Facebook. I need to be here and there and everywhere. And he said, that's not how it works. He said, find a few channels. He said, it should be no more than four. Ideally, it should probably be maybe three or even two to start and do those well and just milk those for what they're worth. Really hit those home. That was one thing that I really pulled away. And the other thing I pulled away was his emphasis on data collection. And I run into this problem, businesses I own, all the time, is I always want the data collection to be perfect. And then I get kind of lost in the weeds, right? You get all this data in front of you. You have your analytics. You have all this stuff coming in. And you're like, what do I do with this? And his response was what I've heard from so many other successful entrepreneurs, just start doing something with it. You know, he said, go out and hire a college kid, go out on Upwork and have them put it into Excel and start analyzing the data. He said, the data will start bubbling up from that by itself and start giving you insights. And then that can direct you into what you should actually be collecting. Fascinating conversation from somebody who's done some pretty big time stuff.
Yeah, sounds like that data will speak to eventually. And even though when he left, it's a $1 billion company, I think that the lessons that he's learned along the way are incredibly valuable for those doing six and seven figures in revenue. You know, a few weeks ago, we had Ryan Daniel Moran on the podcast and he said, find your customers and then send them to the least
path of resistance to ordering. So it's going to be interesting to see how those two things jive with Babak and what he said here in the podcast. Let's get to it.
Absolutely. Let's go.
Babak Azad, thank you for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Glad to be here.
Did I butcher your name?
You did not. You did it well the first time. Thank you.
We literally just rehearsed this. We rehearsed it and then I hit record. Like, I'm still going to screw this thing up. Cool. Hey, thanks so much for joining me. I know you and I talked about a year ago for a piece I wrote on entrepreneur.com, and super glad to have you on the podcast right now. We have a little bit of a tradition here at Quiet Light where we have our guests introduce themselves because, hey, you're better at knowing what your background is than I am. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself real quick?
Sure. So I live here in LA, my wife and two boys. I started out as a math major, investment banking, business school, kind of came from that route. Started a magazine here in LA, which failed miserably. Best 25 grand I ever lost. I needed some humble pie at that point in my life. And then spent 8 years at Beachbody. So the bulk of my professional experience was there, built analytics, and then oversaw media and customer acquisition. So P90X, Insanity, 21 Day Fix, Shakeology, all that. I was there for 8 years, and we kind of had a nice clean 10X. I'd already got there at 100 million, so it was already substantial scale. Really, obviously, helped to push that thing to over a billion. And I left 3 years ago, right when my second son was born. The simple version is I went to start something, the team fell apart really quickly, and then I started working and building a consulting business. So that's what I do right now, help generally 7- and 8-figure businesses, sometimes 9, on heavy on marketing support around customer acquisition, retention, and analytics, and really much more recently heavily infused with customer experience, and really how to, I'm in the midst of writing a book about it too, but really just the power of customer experience that's very much consistent with performance marketing approach, but also really layering in building a lasting brand. That's really where my focus is today, and love what I'm doing. Got some great clients, and having a good time with it.
I love that you lead with the fact that you had a magazine startup that failed, and then you just kind of gloss over the fact that you were part of the team that grew Beachbody from 100 million to $1 billion. You know, just small little footnote in your career history there.
Yeah, it's. I appreciate all the experiences. You never want to go through those negative ones. I think we all have gone through them, and that just. I'd say I'm not sure as humble as I need to be at times, but certainly that was, as I mentioned, it was an important thing of learning what it's like. I'd been really much more of an analyst at that point. And then, yeah, I mean, Beachbody was awesome. You know, I had a great experience, but it was time for me to go. You know, 8 years was a long time there. And, I grew a lot, met my wife through one of my best friends there, and certainly teed me up for kind of this next chapter that I'm in right now. So.
Cool. Well, we're going to be talking today about customer acquisition and also building a brand and some of the lessons that you pulled away from Beachbody and are now doing its round two ventures. Is that right? You're doing this round two? Okay.
Yep.
And we'll link to round two ventures and then your personal blog in our show notes and anything else that you want us to link to in the show notes. But so we're going to be talking a little bit about customer acquisition, lifetime value, and this intersection of brand. And you have kind of this unique way of looking at this customer acquisition strategy. Maybe we could just kind of start out with kind of a general look at your philosophy when it comes to customer acquisition in the e-commerce, but also in the SaaS world. I think metrics being really metric heavy on customer acquisition lifetime values, this is really kind of a SaaS world sort of conversation, but you take it towards e-commerce and towards every other type of business as well.
Yeah, it's funny because I started really with physical products, and even that distinction between physical product. I mean, we sold DVDs and multivitamins, right, at Beachbody, and that's really where a lot of my real marketing and just, I would say, professional experience came from. And so this distinction of physical versus info versus SaaS really was nothing I ever really considered until I started, frankly, getting out of that world and talking to other folks, you know, when I was at Beachbody and then starting to learn about this. But yeah, I mean, so first of all, I was a math major, but, you know, I wrote a piece a bunch of years ago saying, you know, business metrics are not college math and they're barely high school math. And I think, you know, I think that's first thing is I know a lot of people who are intimidated by the metrics or certainly daunted by how do you do it or their systems. And, you know, I'm a firm believer first, just start with something. I think it's Peter Drucker, you know, who said, you know, what you don't measure doesn't get better. And certainly the opposite is very much the case that what you do measure, what you report on, what you send in an email or whatever hits your phone, because it's front of mind, you just start to pay attention. So there's always a bit of grounding of just the basics and fundamentals. And that's really, I think, my approach. I'm not a shiny, bright object guy. I believe that if you hit the basics and fundamentals, then much of what you need to do starts to take care of itself. But really, when it comes to customer lifetime, I mean, how I look at e-com and frankly, all the businesses. You know, fundamental is I grew up as a paid media guy in marketing, and I think it's evolving over time. But, you know, certainly Beachbody and beyond, heavy on TV, heavy on digital, you know, that was what I knew. And certainly one of the core tenets, if you're going to run paid, is you got to know what a customer is worth. You know, people sometimes ask, like, what's a good CPA? It's like, I don't know how to answer that question because I don't know your business. I don't know what a customer is worth. You know, are you, do you have business constraints around needing to be cash flow positive on day one, on day 30? Like, do you have business goals? There's so many factors that come into this. But really, my belief is, and I just don't know any other way, is especially when you're running paid media, you need to know what a customer is worth because you need to know how much to afford to how much you can afford to pay for them. That sounds really basic and fundamental, and hopefully for a lot of folks that is. But you know, that's the core of it, because ultimately it's how do you know if you're going to spend more or less? How do you know if your numbers, whether in Facebook or otherwise, are good or not? You have to have some of that measure. So a lot of the core work that I do with folks, and really I write about, and you know, all that is, really, if you're going to be running paid, you need to understand those basics around around customer acquisition. And then again, start with whatever you have, even if it's all customers. It's, you're not dissecting by ad set or by Facebook versus Google. Just start somewhere, and then you start to refine this over time.
All right. I love these conversations because I go into them sometimes not knowing what I'm going to ask. And then after the first 2 or 3 minutes, I've got a list of questions. So let's start real, real basic. You said start with the basics and fundamentals. What are those? What should somebody be tracking at a minimum?
So let's assume whether you're a SaaS business, info product, physical product, you know, certainly from a traffic side, you know, the core stuff of spend, you know, click-through rate, CPCs, click-through rate, cost per click, conversions, cost per acquisition, whatever that means for you. For some folks, that's if you're lead gen versus you're driving to an order, those are just conventions. And so the philosophical stuff and the strategic stuff applies to both. Certainly you want funnel metrics, how many people hit your site, whether it's landers or blog pages, you know, get through the funnel. And so whether you have a one step or a five step process, I would say, again, start with, if you have GA set up or you have other tools set up, what kind of just basic tracking of how many people are hitting pages, what's your conversion rate, average order value, and then ideally over time, and whether it's someone converts on day zero or beyond, what is the value of those people over time? So I generally try to look in bite-sized chunks of day zero, day one to 30, 31 to 60, and then beyond. And depending on your risk profile, your business goals, all those things, you may determine how long you want to look out and how much you want to apply towards customer acquisition. So
let's talk about that a little bit here, because this is something that I've run across a few times recently. You're looking out over these different strata of periods of time, right? 0 to 28, you know, and then this kind of second up to maybe around 60 days. Why are you taking a look at that? And you're taking a look at this in terms of the value that client's going to bring to you, right?
Right.
So why break it out into that those different groups?
Well, first and foremost, you know, depending on the business goals and constraints, that's oftentimes going to define how you're going to approach managing, let's say, again, we're going to talk about paid media for a moment. That's going to manage that, because if you look at, if you need to be break even based on credit terms, cash flow, whatever that is, if you need to be break even by day 30 or day 60, then you need to know what that customer is worth. And so based on a margin basis, not just certainly on a revenue basis, but on a margin basis, you need to know how much you're making by day 30, by day 60, cumulative, and that's going to help to define what your CPA targets are. And then it's, there again, for me, there's no right and wrong. Whether you're managing to a break even, to a margin percent, if you're just revenue driven and you got venture funding and you need to be driving, those are not for me to say, and I never have a perspective of right and wrong. It's, those are personal and business decisions, but you need to understand that. And then frankly, once you have some of these baselines, then it's a matter of how do you start to improve those things over time, right? So if you know what day one through 30, 31 through 60, then presumably someone on your team, whether it's the owner, the single person, or someone on the team, is spending time testing to say, how do we actually start to drive this and improve that? And again, like again, you different models, you may need to look out 180 days. You may look out a year. I mean, I work with folks that have a 1 year break even because they can afford to do that. Some folks break even on day one. And so different businesses and different models can allow for that. And some it's much more difficult. So you just have to understand the nature of your business and then what kind of things you're trying to constrain with.
Yeah, by way of example, so something that I've run into in a business recently where we had a solid lifetime value number. We were able to calculate it pretty well by taking a look at customers that had left. It was a subscription-based business. We took a look at customers that had canceled over the last 6 months and looked at their average lifetime value. And, you know, the number was something like, I don't know, $130, right? $130, $140. But the average ticket value for any single sale was maybe about $30, $35. And what we found was that there was these whales in there, right? These whales in there that were spending $3,000, and it took them years to be able to get to that point, right? So when you take a look at that lifetime value analysis of saying, okay, that they might be worth $140 or $130, whatever the number was, but in order to do that, you need a couple of these whales to wait for, you know, 3-4 years before you can actually get that value back. So we had to kind of take a look at that from that kind of strategic way of saying, okay, actually, what are we getting from clients on average in month one, and then in month two, and then in month three, and beyond that? We're not going to care too much about the lifetime value because it's going to take too long to recoup that cost.
Right. Yeah. And some businesses may not be able to afford to wait that long for those whales to kick in. And really then it means, A, you're managing your risk in a certain way, again, whatever is appropriate. And then you're basically operating at a higher margin than maybe you could operate if you could tolerate that. And maybe you would take some of that and spend it into media. But if you can't wait that long and there's just too much risk and it's too small of a percent and too inconsistent, then that may just be the way you run it. I think I get in some ways the same question when you're first starting. That's great if you have 5 years of data and you have a much more sophisticated and robust, hopefully, data in your business. But if when you're just starting, you probably need to start more conservative, right? And anyone who's bootstrapped a business knows that you start with what you can afford. And then as you learn, as you develop, and have the history in the business, then you start to understand your customers better, what they're worth, and then maybe you can start to manage your media and how you think about that better. And certainly, hopefully, concurrently, you're optimizing your funnel so your customers are worth more, you're converting better, all these types of things, right? But that's just the nature of, again, where businesses are in their maturity and how long they've been around, right?
Yeah. One of the common objections I hear from people, because we ask people who are selling their business all the time, what's the average lifetime value of a client? And one of the biggest objections I get to that is, I have no idea because customers are still with me. You know, and you said something at the beginning, and that is just start. You know, there's a lot of models out there. Just start with something. Do you have a basic model that you like to follow? I know for myself, I just like to take a look at, okay, I might still have customers with us. You know, and from a Quiet Light perspective, we can say the same thing. Our business is typically one-off, but we have people who have sold 2, 3, 4 businesses. All the same, we don't want to assume that. We're just going to take a look at what the lifetime value has been right now with the assumption it could grow. Do you have a recommended model for people that are saying, I don't know how to account for these people that are still with us?
So the fact that a customer is still with you, for me, is not a reason to not understand what a customer is worth. And so let's say they've been with you for, let's say the businesses have been around for a year and you got 20%, 50% of the customers have been around that long. Great. Do the average based on however long that cohort has been around. And if the other ones are, you know, seem like they're directionally going that way, then great. And then as you get more information, you can start to build your model and add to it. But, you know, I think part of the thing also to be careful of it, depending on how long the business has been around, is how many people are you looking at? So if you got 100 customers versus 10,000, you trust more volume, right? And then the other part is just looking at, I like to break things down into monthly cohorts. Let's assume it's purchase. So I'm not lead gen, but it's purchase. I like to look at, who are all the people who first transacted in January, and then in February, and then in March, and look at their relative month one, month two, month three revenues, and certainly, again, margin, and then start to see what kinds of patterns start to form. I mean, again, it's starting really at that level, and then you just start to refine this thing. And as you get more data, and then great, and you start to layer in. So worst case, you're being conservative because you have customers who are going to stick around a little bit longer, but that's a good thing. And that's a good worst case to have, as opposed to certainly the opposite, where you may be overestimating, or you may be only looking at one group that's worth a ton and everyone else isn't remotely tracking towards that super high value group.
Yeah, I think a problem that people run into a lot is they let the perfect be the enemy of the good. They want to get that perfect model. And if they don't think they can get it, then they don't do it. I know I've fallen victim to that quite a bit as well. I want to talk about
the quote I have on my phone that shows up is perfect, or done is better than perfect. And it's really easy to get stuck in that analysis paralysis, perfection, like And also, frankly, this idea that everyone else has it better. I think a lot of people think that bigger companies or those using better tools always have better data. Like, that is definitely not the case. Like, a lot of times the bigger companies have too many legacy systems. So I think oftentimes that comparison can be can hold people back because they think, I'm never going to be able to achieve what someone else is doing or all that big data stuff. I mean, just start with what you got, and literally it could be Excel with a college kid, and then you start building from there. Like, literally, like, it can be that can be very, very effective. And I've seen it be that way.
Yeah, that's a good lead into my next question, because, you know, you started at Beachbody with $100 million in revenue, right? So you guys want to go ahead and start digesting data. You put $1 million towards hiring on a new team just to be able to digest data. The entrepreneur who has an e-commerce business doing, you know, $3 million, $4 million bucks, mm-hmm. that's a lot more of a challenge for them to bring on sure. that much of a team. Excel analytics, are there any other programs that they might want to look at or systems that you know of that might be a good starting point? Or would you even recommend going out and hiring a college kid or going on to a place like Upwork to be able to have somebody start to crunch numbers?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, when I joined, again, it was 07. What you think maybe a $100 million business has in terms of systems and processes, I would say, first of all, the tools today are so, so much better. But looking back, I work with some $100 million businesses now that have dramatically better systems and reporting, frankly, because the tools are just that much easier. So, you know, it took a year or so for me to get relatively cleaner data, not even clean. So first of all, even back then, it wasn't like everything was so dialed in. That's kind of part of my point, right? And then second, again, like, depending on people, whether on Shopify or Magento or whatever your platform, honestly, the basic thing is do a data dump. I've hired for multiple clients, someone part-time on Upwork to basically do some slicing and dicing, basic stuff, get some things in place. And we're not talking, so first of all, even if you hire someone full-time, and let's say that person is $50,000 a year, just picking a number, your exposure to that person is not 50,000, because within 90 days, you should know whether that person's going to be working out or not. So let's say it's a quarter of that, plus maybe a little bit more. So oftentimes, first, people think about if they're going to bring on someone full-time, that annualized cost, that's really not what it is. You should know, I think, within 90 days that you're getting what you need and they're on a path. But at the very least, there are definitely folks on Upwork and really just looking for, you know, someone who's got some similar work. I put people through an Excel test to make sure they can do the basics. It's all made up information. And yeah, you just start with that. And I've literally had college kids help out just who are good at Excel. They don't need to know that much. They just need to know how to slice and dice some information. And maybe it's an MBA. Like, I'm not saying you have to go there, but certainly Upwork, Excel, you know, using, again, basic tools, you know, you do not need certainly anything remotely close to enterprise to get stuff going. And I will say, I run some numbers for some of my clients, and it's literally, you know, I did one a week ago, Excel, HubSpot, Shopify, GA, pieced it all together. And we had a pretty rich view. Took some time, obviously, but, you know, we then had a pretty rich view of what those customers look like.
So with somebody who has, say, a Shopify store or an Amazon store, where you can't really track customers as well with Amazon, but let's say a Shopify store where you can track your customers, or a SaaS application or anything else where you're tracking those customers, would you literally just go out and do a dump of that data of the customers and go back and start to calculate, okay, this is what, you know, graphing it out. These customers were worth this much in that those first 30 days, and then it starts to look like this when we move out?
Yep, that's exactly. I mean, so, and that's what we did. You know, let's say you're looking at 2017 data. It's literally who are all the new customers? And that's part of the thing is making sure they're new versus repeat. But let's just say you can identify that hopefully relatively easily. Who are all the new customers who purchased for the first time in January of 17, February of 17, March of 17, and literally track those people. Look at their February orders for January. Look at the March orders for both, like, you know, January and February. And really, that's literally started that way. And you can then start to slice and dice by traffic source, by product, by offer, by ad set. But that's next level for some folks. They just want to get the pure basics. Just start with that average thing. And then once you have that, then you start to refine over time. But literally, it's a data dump. And, you know, if you can marry it with GA or with your CRM or ESP, then great. But at the very least, start with the overall, start with it, maybe one line, and then you just start to get better from that point. And frankly, again, like, that's what I did with Beachbody. That's what I do with my clients. and or whether it's me or working with their teams, you just start and then you start to refine over time.
All right. So let's go to the other side of this conversation. We started to get a good sense for our lifetime value and what a client brings to us in terms of different timeframes, right? That first 30 days, that next, the first 60 days and so on and so forth. And we know our cash flow requirements. Again, people listening, you have to keep in mind, you know, if you're going to spend $50 on a client and they're not going to pay you $50 until month six, you need enough cash flow to be able to get to that payback period. Let's build the strategy. What does the strategy look like then at that point from acquiring the customers and going through different channels? I know obviously with Beachbody, you guys did television, you did radio, you did a lot of media, which was hard to track. And we see this a lot with, you know, online platforms are really good right now at tracking, you know, with view through conversions and everything else, but there's still some of those mediums out there that aren't great and imperfect. How does that start to factor into your decisions when it comes to acquisition channels?
Yeah. I mean, so no matter what channel you're in, attribution is the bane of everyone's existence. Very, very few people have it down. And like, I don't even know what that means to have it down. You want to get to the point where you feel like a level of comfort and confidence. You know, these days, again, most of the work, I have one client that I work with on TV, and it's a very rare exception of how good their attribution model is. But let's say that for the most part, most people are doing, I mean, it's digital heavy, right? So for me, I basically focus and work with folks on really only a few channels. So Google, which for me is Google and Bing. I think people always forget about Bing. It's another 5-10%. And my joke is, if you don't want that 5-10%, can I have it? And I'm joking, but no one ever says yes. But it's usually higher ROI, especially when you're talking slightly older demos. But Google and Bing, Facebook and Instagram, your internal email and affiliates. And frankly, just, and I say just, but if you focus there, I've seen plenty of businesses grow well into nine figures. Focus there. And then certainly you can layer on radio and podcast, TV, direct mail. But honestly, Google, Facebook, affiliates, email, and internal email, that's really where I put a lot of time and attention. And I'll say even then, attribution is a bit of a mess because Facebook and Google don't talk to each other, right? So they're each want to take some credit. You know, are you using GA, last click? What's happening? Are people opting in through Facebook and then converting through email? But you really just have to start to piece together things. At the end of the day, again, depending on your business model, your P&L and your bank account are the true measures of it. And so that sounds like a totally average overall view. But yeah, that's, again, I work with folks that have that, and then they've gotten to a certain level of sophistication. So you start with, you know, start and piece together. What does Google say? What does Facebook say? Like, if you add up those two, do you even have that many orders? They're going to have to, you have to be very careful about double counting, but you just start to piece together this, the data starts to tell a bit of a story. I will just say one thing. You mentioned view through. I am very, very, very conservative on view through to the point where basically I ignore it. Certainly from a GDN side and really even from Facebook. I just think unless you prove it, I'd rather start with the default that it doesn't work and then you got to prove it as opposed to disproving it. But I know that's, you know, 28-day click, one-day view on Facebook is the standard setup. I move most people to 7-day click, not because it's right, but mostly because it we got to account for double counting, AdWords, what's going on in email, things like that. So there's no right and wrong, but that's one of the places I've kind of dialed in a little bit is looking at 7-day click. But honestly, the biggest mistake I oftentimes see with people with channels is they have too many. And so I think it's people say, oh, I heard someone's doing something on Pinterest or YouTube, or I got to do this. Frankly, if I see people who have four channels where it's 25% in each, that says actually something is not being done well enough. And usually it's people who are really scaled. I kind of have this thing of two offers, two channels. Most businesses that have scaled substantively, they've gone deep and hard in a couple channels, which basically means they've left probably some money on the table elsewhere. Maybe, but it means they're focused and that means they're exploding where things are working. And so I think that's one of the things people think, I got to be in so many places. I have not found that to be the case at all. And even though it sounds like you're concentrating your risk, it also means you're exploiting an opportunity. And that's really, I think, oftentimes what you're really trying to do.
How do you know when to give up on a channel if it's not working? Or would you?
You know, it's a good question. You know, I think at some point you have to make a call. So I don't have a rule around it. Let me put it that way. Hard and fast. I think it's, first of all, I like modeling off of other people, not copying, but modeling. And so it can be dangerous because you can see all these other people seemingly running a bunch of ads and yours may not be working, but you may not know what their goals are, and their goals may be different than yours. So I think it's always, you gotta be careful about comparison, but you know, I think at some point you have to take, just like a lot of things, you gotta take an honest assessment and say, do we feel like we've given this a fair shot? How much time and money have we invested? Frankly, what is it pulling? Because we all have trade-offs. Whether you're a six-figure business or a nine-figure business, everyone is resource constrained in their own relative way. So you have to pick and choose your battles and really where you think. Now, I guess, and sometimes the market may be telling you something too, that it may not be the channel, it may be the way you're executing on it, right? Which may be kind of the same thing for you. But I think that's one of the things too, is really you have to take an honest assessment of what have you done? What have you tried? Have you talked to people? Have you pulled in, whether experts or friends, or done some research? And, you know, I think then it's, you know, relative to other things that you have in front of you, where is your time, your capital, your resources better allocated?
Yeah. All right. That's awesome. All right. I told you before we started recording this that we were not going to get to the one thing I really wanted to talk to. So I'm going to get to it now. And that is something that I find fascinating about your approach to direct response marketing, right? Because direct response marketing, we often think about in terms of the money that goes in. We want to make sure that we're getting a positive ROI out of that. And we're just measuring that and that alone. We see it almost as this opposite of brand marketing, which is, you know, splash it out there, splash it out there, splash it out there, and it's kind of a long play. But you have this intersection, and you did this a lot with Beachbody as well. You have this intersection of brand and also the direct response. If somebody's focusing on those four that you put out, right, the Facebook, the Google, affiliate, and the internal email, what can they do to start building a brand, and why is that important?
Yeah, so I think the first distinction is around something you said, and I think a lot of people will latch onto, which is brand marketing. And so really what I focus on and try to talk to folks about is building a brand. And so for me, the distinction is brand marketing oftentimes is associated with you spend a bunch of money on media, marketing, whatever, that's basically non-trackable and that is trying to build brand awareness, but without necessarily tying it to some kind of metric. And I say that as opposed to focusing on building a brand, for me, that's really comes down to the customer experience. And so those are totally can be integrated with a performance marketing direct response model. And really that's about how do you start to take care of the customer and treat them, frankly, like you would want to be treated if you were the customer. And so I think it's less about brand marketing initiatives, and it's more about this idea of, does the word in the lexicon around building a brand, about building something that's lasting, how often does that come up in the organization? I had breakfast actually with a friend this morning, and we're talking about the idea of what's on brand versus off and what that means. But really, at the end of the day, is are you building something that's got some sense of sustainability? And I think oftentimes, especially when you're earlier on, the idea of shortcuts, of doing things that are maybe, whether it's not as clean or not as brand building, I get that. Everyone's got to make their call around those things. But ultimately, if you want to build something that's got some sense of scale and got some sense of sustainability, I do believe you have to be focused on building a brand. Because when you do that, you start to treat the customer better. You start to invest more in your product. You start to invest more in the kinds of media. And frankly, that kind of stuff can be infused in your acquisition efforts. You know, I mentioned, I think I'm writing a book on customer experience, and that really came from how do you start to bring DR and brand together? And really things like tapping into a sense of identity and community, that's not just brand marketing that's non-trackable. You can start to build that into your video ads on Facebook. Dollar Beard Club, now the Beard Club, and they've done a phenomenal job of, there's this sense of identity and association with, you're a man with a beard. And so they tap into that and who you are, what that means. And so that is one layer of customer experience and building that brand that is clearly tied to performance marketing, but it starts to infuse that. I would say two things like, you know, so my four categories really are around the human and emotional stuff. There's product, there's the transactional experience, and then there's content like video. And they're not mutually exclusive by any stretch. But I'll say like with subscription businesses, whether online, I mean, media, SaaS, or physical box, one of the best places or best examples I see people have make some mistakes is around order notification. So this is not brand marketing. This is, are you treating the customer better? Are you letting them know that next order is going to ship, that next billing is going to happen? And oftentimes I see people say, well, if I send an email before that billing, my churn rate's going to go up. And my response is, absolutely, you're correct. But also, you know, what happens is your customer is actually aware of that billing. They're not annoyed. I mean, I think we've all faced that thing where, whether it's a meal subscription or otherwise, a billing happened, we didn't know about it, we're annoyed, we got to go cancel, we tell our friends, we post. That kind of stuff absolutely has an impact on the brand. And honestly, one of the best examples I've seen of how to use that notification positively is Dollar Shave Club. They send the notification, but they use that as a promotional opportunity to say, your order's about to ship, do you want to add something to it? And so whether it's their shaving cream or any of their other products, they use that. And again, 20 or 30% of people are going to order, open your email if you're lucky. So it's not everyone, but you get the brand benefit of notification, but then you use that as a promotional opportunity to say, do you want to add something more? And I would much rather be playing in that kind of world rather than trying to sneak in what you think is one or two more orders. But it's very hard to quantify, but you absolutely are hurting the brand if you're playing a longer game when you're trying to sneak stuff in and not be as clean and upfront. And yes, Netflix and DirecTV don't do that. But again, those are very, very different businesses than subscription boxes or something that you start on a risk-free trial that frankly doesn't get the kind of use that, you know, DirecTV and Netflix would.
Could you repeat those four categories again? Those are great.
So the first one is really, I talk about it as like really the human and emotional aspects. So that's things like identity, community, exclusivity, things that are raw human needs and traits. The second is really product. And there are multiple layers on it, but I think it's kind of crazy that I have to focus and emphasize it. But the number of people that I see that don't have the attention to detail on product, especially people starting, they want a private label, fine. But the better your product, best product doesn't always win, but a better product gives you a better chance at that. Third is the transactional experience. So how do you take people through your funnel? What is it like to get a refund? What is it like to talk to customer service? Those kinds of things. And the fourth is content. So how do you use video, music, spokesperson or character? And really each of these things, there are plenty of examples of companies that are using all of them or just one of them to really start to enhance that experience and really start to wow their customers. I mean, that's the Zappos kind of thing, but you basically need customers these days to be blown away. It is, you know, when I say like, it's, when people say it's the easiest time to start a business because generally the tools are easier, but it's also like, that means it's brutally difficult to compete and to differentiate. So you've got to be just a ton better than everyone else. And my experience is that customer experience and these kinds of things is really what you need. And again, it's infusing this idea of playing the longer game into performance marketing and direct response. These two are not at odds.
Cool. All right. You have a book that you're writing right now. Do you have any idea when that's going to be done?
Best case is Thanksgiving time, but I've started, I mean, I'm happy to post a couple links to some of the things I've started to write about, whether on LinkedIn or on Twitter, so just to kind of go a little bit deeper into these and show some specific examples. But yeah, we're still talking a few months out.
Okay. I know we've had a couple other people that are writing books and we always get emails after saying, hey, can I get notified when that book is out? So do us a favor. When you do have that out, send me a message and I'll make sure I update anyone that wants to be updated on that. And then where can people learn more about you? Obviously Round 2 Ventures, any other place?
Yeah. I mean, my business is Round 2. It's Round 2 Partners, but it's the website, same thing. I mean, it's a holding company, but my blog is the easiest. It's just my name. It's Bob Akazad, BABAKAZAD.com. And you know, that's where I put a lot of content there. And then frankly, there in LinkedIn, I'm at Bob Akazad pretty much on everything other than Gmail of all things. But another Bob Akazad stole that from me, but not stole, he was earlier. But yeah, I'm on pretty much every platform, but my blog and LinkedIn are the two easiest by far.
Fantastic, this was great. So, thanks so much for coming on. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.